Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're enjoying your lunch. I'll shortly be introducing our speaker today. A few housekeeping points before that. Firstly, of course, you could join me in turning your phones to silent. A mention of a couple of other fantastic speakers we have coming up here. Tomorrow, we have David Yang Zhouren, who will be talking about why China is promoting Confucianism. And a week from now, at dinner, we will be having Manu Bhaskaran talking about the outlook for Southeast Asia this year. There have been a lot of positive trends, but he will be telling us that there are some dangerous details to be aware of. In terms of details and their dangers, I guess our speaker today is most eminently qualified to talk about them. Lord Peter Goldsmith was an eminent barrister in London, becoming a Queen's Counsel in 1987. For joining the Lords and then later the government as Attorney General. Today, he is also a Privy Councillor and the Head of Asian and European Disputes at Defroy's and Plimpton, the New York law firm. And he's actually involved in some fantastic cases that we as journalists would love to hear more about, but of course he can't possibly comment. For foreign correspondents, The developments in the Middle East recently with the deaths of Marie Colvin in Syria, attempting to tell the truth, attempting to tell the story of wars, are very, very important things to us. But of course, the decisions and discussions that are going on behind closed doors in these most difficult times of considering issues of law, war, and terror are of fantastic interest and importance to us as well. And to that regard, we are honored and delighted to have Lord Peter Goldsmith talk to us today.
There was a professor of astrophysics who used to travel the country from town to town giving a lecture on astrophysics. And on one occasion, he arrived, always driven by his driver, and he said, I can't deliver this lecture. I've lost my throat. I've got a very bad case of laryngitis. The driver said, no problem. I can deliver it for you. I've been listening to this for months and months. I know it worked perfectly. Said the professor, that sounds a bit unexpected. All right, we'll give it a try. So he went to sit at the back of the hall, and the driver went to the front and delivered this lecture absolutely perfectly. And then he was asked a question about astrophysics. The driver stood for a moment, he looked, he said, look, that question is so easy. Even my driver can answer that. He's sitting at the back of the hall. I don't have a driver at the back of the hall. I've got, I'm glad to say, some colleagues from my firm. So if there are difficult questions after this, they will be answering them. Not me. So on the 11th of June 2001, Tony Blair had just won his second general election. Government had been returned with a very substantial majority, and he already believed that the problem with his first term, as you will recall, a historic landslide victory after 18 years of the Conservative Party, he already believed that the problem with it was that he hadn't actually achieved what his policies had intended. So he made it clear that his policy for his next term was going to be delivery. It was all going to be about delivery. The problem was that 3 months to the day after he said that, 9/11 took place, and that changed everything. And what took place on that day and its aftermath, two wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, new terrorist laws, new challenges, new dangers, were to dominate that term and indeed his next term as well. And it was on that day, the 3 months to the day before 9/11, that he asked me to be his Attorney General. As you'll know, British government posts are different from some other countries like the US. You don't know before you actually take office that you're about to take office. It happens very, very suddenly. So I got the call, actually, when I was at home waiting for a car to take me to an airport to make a speech in Stockholm about something I'd done also for the government, when he asked me if I take on the job of Attorney General. I didn't have to think very long. It seemed a good idea. But then I had to find out what actually was to happen. So I rang up, I looked in the telephone directory to find out the telephone number for the Attorney General's office. And I rang up, and I asked to speak to the Attorney General's private secretary. A man came on the phone. I said, that's who I am, I'm Lord Goldsmith. I've just been appointed by the Prime Minister. Oh, he said, in very unflappable British civil service style, to which post? I said, oh, Attorney General. Ah, he said, yes, we thought so. Now, I still don't know. I still, to this day, do not know whether that was just a very good start to our relationship or he actually was in on it from the beginning. But that day was not only to change Tony Blair's tenure as Prime Minister, ultimately, I think, leading to his having to leave office because of the unpopularity of certain things that had taken place. It made a huge difference to me as well, because from that moment, from the moment of 9/11, this issue of terrorism, how to deal with it, dominated my agenda as well. And I wanted just to spend a few minutes lifting the curtain on some of the things that we had to deal with during that period. Let me just say a word about the role of the UK Attorney General. Some of you will know that well. For others, it won't be so familiar. And also about the role of law in modern government, because that's at the heart of this. The Attorney General in the UK is responsible for all private public prosecutions, supervises the directors of public prosecution, there are several of them, and also has a responsibility for criminal law and justice, but is also the chief legal advisor to the government, which is a hugely wide and varied area of activity. And in my case also, I represented the government in court frequently, something which in the States, for example, is now devolved to the Solicitor General, but in the UK it's different. The Attorney General originally was, that's what he was the barrister, he was the lawyer for first the King and then the government, and originally was actually paid case by case. That changed in the 1930s when the Attorney General went on to a salary. And if you look at the law books, the number of cases which personally the Attorney General did seemed to have dropped dramatically after that moment. I'm sure the pressures of work simply rose as it happened. And indeed, the Attorney General was actually allowed to act for other clients as well. And it said that William Gladstone, when he was Prime Minister, he had some tricky problem, and he asked for his office to get the Attorney General to come around to advise him. And he was told, well, I'm terribly sorry, Prime Minister, the Attorney General's busy prosecuting a case in the Old Bailey. Oh, all right, well, what about the Solicitor General? Well, he's representing a commercial client in the High Court at the moment. That was the moment, again, from which the Attorney General were told they couldn't act for any private clients. So you didn't get paid by the case, and you couldn't act for anyone else at all. Why would anyone want to do the job? But the significance of law in government cannot be overestimated. There are whole armies of people whose job it is to make laws, of course, but also whole armies of people whose job it is to help the government keep to the law and to act in accordance with domestic and international law, which in the UK is increasingly important. The two supranational European bodies, for example, who now impose quite significant constraints, I have no problem with that myself, but others do, on what government does. The historian A.P. Hartley once said that before the Second World War, the only civil servants that an honest man would come into contact with would be the taxman and the postman. That has completely changed, and the result is that the series of laws which govern every aspect of life mean that government needs to be directed, needs to be guided, needs to be advised constantly by lawyers. And the job of the Attorney General is to sit at the top of an apex of about 6,000 lawyers whose job it is to deal with all of these issues, the prosecutions, but also the advice and the legislation. And so the variety is considerable. Even things like the Olympic Games, exciting though it is as an event, created a great deal of legal issues, compulsory purchase, planning issues, and even the question whether it was permissible to use the Royal Parks for beach volleyball. The answer is it is. And it'll be happening just near my house in June. But the point I wanted particularly to pick up on was the relevance of law to terrorism and the issues that we were facing after 9/11. And you need to understand how pervasive law is in these areas. For example, in modern warfare, we have lawyers who are advising on the conduct of military operations from the centre of government, but also on the battlefield itself. We have, the United Kingdom has lawyers embedded in its operations in theatre who are advising commanders what they can do. And the reason for this is because the series of laws, which we now call international humanitarian law, we used to call them the laws of war, that's no longer an appropriate name, but international humanitarian law sets down limits and parameters on how military action can be used. Most important is the Geneva Conventions and the additional protocol to the Geneva Convention, which sets out what the limits are on the use of force. And I'll come in a moment to the commencement of hostilities, but my responsibility included what took place during the conflict, so that during the Afghanistan war, for example, my wife used to put out the water and the coffee at 11 o'clock at night, because at that time the targeters would come around and the military advisors would come around to tell me what military action they were planning for the following day, what bombing campaigns, and we would look at that together to see whether, in my view, it satisfied the law. And the reason is because you have to operate under modern conditions on the basis that civilian populations are protected completely from harm. You cannot do that, but that they are not subjected unnecessarily to harm. And so there are some quite detailed rules which apply to ensure that the use of force is not excessive to the military objective that's being obtained. That wasn't something that my training as a lawyer had particularly equipped me for, but you pick up pretty quickly what the rules there are. Let me turn then, though, to what happened on 9/11, because it became relatively clear to me, as to others, that at the end of the day, the critical question in dealing with the response to these activities was one of balance. It's balance between competing interests. The very first time that became clear to me was on 9/11 itself, when, going back to my office after the report of the first plane hitting the first of the towers, we watched the second plane going in and immediately realized that we would have an issue because we had an airport, London City Airport, also close to skyscrapers, Canary Wharf, and a concern that there could, for all we know, have been planes actually heading towards Canary Wharf at that time. It wouldn't have been a huge surprise if that had been so. We actually got to close down City Airport to avoid that risk, or to avoid office workers being terrified of it. But I had to consider the legal question. If we did know that a plane appeared to be heading way off course and had some reliable belief that there were terrorists on board, what do you do? Do you take the decision to shoot that plane down with civilians on board, knowing that they are probably doomed in any event, but that way you will save far more lives? Now that remains, obviously it would have been, if it had ever happened, it would have been a huge political decision to take, and it came close to the decision having to be taken on one occasion. But it's also a legal question as to whether you can take that decision, exercising that balance. I'm going to spell out in a few moments, if I may, how we try to deal with those. But let me, because it's impossible, I wouldn't want to avoid the question, let me also then deal with the commencement of military operations as well. And in particular, let me say something about Iraq. I'm very well aware how unpopular that was in my country and with many other people as well. Very big policy issues at stake. Issues, as it turned out, about the quality of the intelligence were particularly important, though no one at the time realized it. Remember that when the key resolution, 1441, was passed by the United Nations, all 15 members of the Security Council, both the permanent and the non-permanent members, voted for it unanimously, including Syria. So there was a unanimity of view about both the threat and the legal issue, which I'm now going to turn to. I'm going to be a little bit circumspect about what I say. You will know that we still have an ongoing inquiry into Iraq, the Chilcot inquiry, which still hasn't reported. And it's possible, I would say unprofitably, but it is possible to spend a lot of time on process. But let me just say a few things about my own role. First of all, my responsibility was to give what I believe to be the correct answer in law, not a decision skewed one way or the other, not leaning either towards war or trying to avoid conflict. Those were policy issues for the politicians. My job was to try to give a correct legal assessment, and when I finished assembling all the evidence, having heard all the arguments, having studied all the precedents, that was then the time to reach a judgment. Ultimately, that happened quite late, with a lot unraveling whilst that was taking place. That's the nature of making decisions in real time. But the evidence of compliance and non-compliance, which was coming out of the Security Council, was critical. Well, second question I have to ask myself is, did I get it right? Well, my view remains firmly that I did get it right. And I believe that for a reason I'll explain more strongly today than I even did then. And despite how fashionable it's become to say that this wasn't legal, many distinguished people take a different view. The current British judge on the International Court of Justice is on record as saying that he thought that it was lawful. And there's absolutely no court decision saying it wasn't, not even a UN resolution saying it wasn't. The basis of the decision, we'll just spend a moment on this, was the pre-existing authority of the United Nations in Resolution 678, which was the resolution which started the first Gulf War, which was then suspended by Resolution 687, which was the ceasefire resolution at the end of the first Gulf War. And that ceasefire resolution did not bring to an end the authority to use military action. It suspended it, and that was demonstrated on two subsequent occasions when, in 1993 and 1998, military action was taken against Iraq, relying upon the original authority that had been given, and indeed supported by the then Secretary General of the United Nations, at least on the first occasion. And if you study the history of Iraq, you'll be struck by, I think, three things. First of all, that the business of the first Gulf War was never really finished. The weapons inspection regime wasn't invented by Bush and Blair in 2002. It was invented as a way of controlling Iraq after the ceasefire. Because of the belief of the international community that Saddam Hussein hadn't given up his ambitions. And the inspections which followed, the deceptions which followed, for example, of a nuclear program that had been denied, but was then revealed by a defector, demonstrated what was actually going on. So you can look at Butler's report, the inspector's report, and the history that follows. The second thing is to notice the number of resolutions that had passed. We had lots and lots of discussion about did it need one or two resolutions. Actually, it was by the time we got to that, it was 17 or 18. Because that is the number of resolutions which had been passed by the UN Security Council before we got to 2003. The sanctions program was still in operation and goes back to the ceasefire and the conditions which were set. And thirdly, as I've already said, the fact that strikes one is that the legal analysis, which we then relied upon in the United Kingdom as justifying our military action, had actually been used on two previous occasions, as I've said. It wasn't actually the so-called revival argument that was the difficult legal issue. What was controversial was discovering just what it was that the Security Council had meant when they passed Resolution 1441. And it had clearly warned of military action if the new demands and inspection regime weren't complied with in full. It expressly stated that this was the final opportunity, the words of the resolution, for Iraq. It didn't say that if there was non-compliance, the Security Council would decide what to do, but only that it would discuss the situation, which it most definitely did. And it became apparent to me that those words had been very carefully chosen. Indeed, a French proposal to put in the word decide had been rejected as not appropriate, because it would have meant giving a veto to the five permanent members, including Russia and France. So there we are. I mean, I looked at all the negotiating materials, which is a benefit that I had that many other people didn't have, considered the arguments, discussed this with legal experts, including from the Foreign Office. But what you can see is that although it was a hugely important issue, like many legal issues, ultimately it came down to be quite a narrow issue. Actually, the military action in Kosovo was legally more controversial. When NATO went into Kosovo, it had no previous supporting authority for the proposition that it could go in on the basis that there was an impending humanitarian catastrophe. Today, most people would say that that is available. Next question I just want to touch on briefly is whether this set, many people have asked this question, did Iraq set a precedent for other cases? The answer is very clearly, in my view, not. It wasn't any authority for a single country or a group of countries to determine that they could act in place of the United Nations. It was a decision based quite specifically on previous authorizations by the Security Council, not just resolutions by the Security Council, but authorizations to use military action, which is what Resolution 678 was. The third point I just want to make about it is what I've been talking about is law. It's not the same as the question of the policy. People sometimes talk about the difference between being legal and legitimate. I'm not sure that's the right language, but certainly there is a huge difference between whether something is legally possible and whether it is right politically to do. And a lot of the debate has been, I think, really focused on the second question, and quite legitimately, because there are lots of reasons for asking the question whether or not politically it was the right thing to do. I mean, as a lawyer, I'm delighted that people should spend so much time worrying about the legal issues of big world issues. But it's a bit conceited for us to think that we're the only ones whose views are worth listening to. We're certainly not. As one of our great judges said, the purpose of the rule of law was not to institute the rule of lawyers. But then the other issue we had to deal with was very much the question of how you balance civil liberties with the risk to your population. And this is what 9/11 really drove home. It wasn't the first time there had been terrorist acts or terrorist threats, but it was the first time there had been terrorist threats of such magnitude, with such determination, with terrorists who were prepared not just prepared, but often eager to lay down their own lives in order to achieve their objective. And as we approach these issues, as was approached in other countries, in the US and other countries, it was necessary, I think, to try and find a principled basis for determining how you approach this question of balance. For me, I eventually took the view that there were three principles that we needed to follow. The first was respect for the rule of law. And that means adhering to our domestic and international legal obligations. You can't simply ignore or set those aside. It also means subjecting the action of the executive to the scrutiny of the democratic institutions and of the courts. One of the big issues I had, and I had several, with what happened in relation to Guantanamo, was that until the Supreme Court had decided otherwise in a case called Roussel and Bush, the view of the American administration was that the US courts had no business considering the lawfulness or the conditions that were taking place in Guantanamo. A fairly extraordinary proposition. True, it was offshore the United States, but the Cuban courts certainly weren't in a position to do that, so it left a great black hole. Second principle is to try to maintain a commitment to fundamental values and freedoms. Now, that doesn't mean that everything applies the same in war as it does in peace. But some things are non-negotiable. Some things can be adjusted. But you have to identify clearly what they are, and you cannot set them all aside. The right to privacy, for example, needs to give way to allow for exceptions to help fighting crime or protecting other people. But things like torture, things like fair trial, to my mind, are non-negotiable principles, which I would not have wanted to see my government giving a way to, which was a reason why, another reason why we strongly opposed, and I strongly opposed Guantanamo, because the military commissions originally in place, and I'm still not very happy with the situation that exists today, did not allow for those principles of fair trial, which we have come to accept as part of the basis of a free society. And the third principle was that in those cases where you could adjust these fundamental freedoms to take account of the problems you were faced with, you had to do that in a way which was proportionate and no more than was necessary to meet the threat. And I'll give you one example of that. We had a long debate in the United Kingdom about whether we would extend the period of detention before charge. Police were able to detain people in normal cases for up to 48 hours and for up to 7 days, and subsequently extended to 14 days before they were charged in terrorist cases. And Tony Blair, it was the first defeat he suffered in government, wanted to extend that to 90 days. I was opposed to that. Indeed, it became a resignation issue for me in the event he lost it in the House of Commons and it never came to my house to vote. Gordon Brown followed the same approach, trying to show that he was tough on terrorism. To my mind, as a lawyer and in charge of prosecutors, I couldn't see what you were going to gain by keeping people detained for that period of time. They're not going to say anything after 14 days, after 30 days, that they wouldn't have said after 7 in the first place. So look to see whether or not what you want to do is proportionate to the threat that you have and is no more than is necessary. Finally, it seemed to me that watching, and I did some time looking at citizenship in the United Kingdom, that you can't actually win this struggle by conventional means alone. You may have to use force, you may have to use the coercive powers of the state, you have to use the criminal law, of course, but there's more you have to do. And ultimately, you have to win, I came to believe, by demonstrating that our values, that the values that we're standing for, are stronger, better, more valid, more legitimate than the value of the people who are seeking to destroy them. And when we look at communities in Britain, where there was a high degree in certain communities of acquiescence, of acceptance of terrorist activities by people within them, you've got to demonstrate to them that actually what we stand for is more valuable, and that is what they should be supporting. And that is something that we need to follow through all of our activities. We need to show that our values of democracy, of tolerance, of acceptance of diversity, and justice above all, are strong. That way, the law and the basic freedoms and values that we support cease to be part of the problem of dealing with terrorism. They become a key part of the solution. Well, I've spoken perhaps for slightly longer than I should have done, with the benefit of some time out of office. I left, as you've heard, in 2007. I'm delighted that one of the things I'm now able to do is spend some time here, a place I very much enjoyed practicing in many, 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 many years ago. I've had to do it joining a US law firm, which is a challenge in itself, mostly the telephone system. I never had this problem before. I discovered that unless you got to grips with the telephone system, you couldn't do any work. You can't put a charge number. I tried to put the charge number into the telephone, and I don't get it in time, and the phone hangs up. I finally solved that problem, which is why I'm able to come out and spend some time with you. You get someone else in the office to make the phone call for you. Thanks very much for listening, and have a good afternoon.
Thank you very much for those comments, Lord Goldsmith. We've got about 10 minutes before 2 o'clock, so and Lord Goldsmith has agreed to take a few questions. So if I can see interest from anyone in the audience, if you could introduce yourself and then ask your question. I see the gentleman.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you very much for a good speech. I've got a quick question about United Nations Security Council Resolution 1373. Which was the asset terrorist financing legislation passed by the UN. And it really talks a little bit about your proportionate and valued response and sort of necessary measures. And the question is really this. That particular piece of legislation could unilaterally freeze people's assets, as you know, without any oversight by the courts, and also without the person whose assets were frozen from being able to challenge that particular freezing measure. And my question is whether the UK system actually considered putting in any checks and balances on that, aside from, of course, Armand and Treasury, which said that was probably unlawful, but to allow, for example, special advocates to be appointed who would be security cleared and would be able to advocate on behalf of the person whose assets were frozen, probably in camera with the courts.
Well, I agree with your point. The system ought to have allowed for opportunities to challenge it from the start. And yes, you're right, there are ways of doing that, but even where there is sensitive security material involved, special advocates are one way of doing it. They're not perfect, but it's the best we were able to come up with. Fundamentally, yes, I agree with you for exactly the reason that you give. Although it's very important to be able to try out sources of terrorist funding, you need to also follow principles of justice and allow people an opportunity of challenging that, because it can destroy lives and destroy businesses and destroy families.
Rachel Curtin. I wonder if you've got any comment on President Obama's apparent inability to close down Guantanamo Bay.
Great frustration. I mean, I was delighted, and indeed it offered unsolicited certain advice as to how he might go about it. I'm delighted when he made that an early commitment, and I'm very sorry that he hasn't achieved it. I still think that, do what we did. I mean, we ended up actually, as a result of my refusal to accept the military commissions, to his credit, President Bush had said that if your Attorney General, he said to Blair, if your Attorney General won't accept this, I will free the British nationals. And though it was very unpopular, and it made me very unpopular in my own government because they didn't like it, that these people came back, that's exactly what happened. And the result was that apart from a bit of relatively mild publicity, as far as I know, none of the people who came back actually caused the problem. Now, I know it can happen in other cases, but to how many terrorists are you creating for each person you keep locked up in a way which many people regard as unjust? I think the balance is very clearly in favour of sticking to the principle, and I wish that President Obama could persuade Congress to allow him to do that.
A question in the veranda. If you could stand up and introduce yourself so that we can... Thank you.
It's Robin Fox, I'm an associate at Lord Guido Goldsmith. It's been reported widely that you changed your mind in the about the legality of the invasion of the Second Gulf War. and that you were lent on to give a more favourable opinion. Could you comment on
absolute,
that, please?
The lent on is absolute nonsense. I get very angry about this. I mean, I gave evidence for 6 hours to Chilcot. If you don't have anything else to do, you can find it on YouTube and watch it. You'll see the detailed questioning and scrutiny. But essentially, this was an unfolding situation. There were reasons why certain issues became stronger in my mind, but absolutely not a question of being lent on. And indeed, there was some strange story about a particular person having written my advice. I used to be in chambers with that guy. He was junior to me. I would never have let him write anything.
On a different topic, Lord Goldsmith, could you say how the new Supreme Court in London is working?
I mean, it's actually working fine. The important thing to note about the new Supreme Court is it's actually a change of address, not a change of function. It's moved from within the Houses of Parliament, within the House of Lords, ceased to be the Judicial Committee of the House of Lords, and become a Supreme Court in a building 200 yards away. That's not even 200 yards away. The judges are essentially the same. Their powers haven't changed at all. I think that over a period of time, it may change, but it's not become a US-style Supreme Court. But functioning well, and the building is very nice.
Hello, I'm Agatha Moore, Chinese University. I would like to ask a question. I have a problem with my students, Chinese university students. They're from Hong Kong people, very smart students. And somehow I have a problem with them to, you talk about values, yeah? We want to spread our values, democracy. They don't believe in democracy anymore, yeah? They are for authoritarian regimes. They said democracy doesn't work. This is, can you help me here? Because I just don't know. I don't know how, I was hoping that I come here, I will learn something, some really strong arguments I can use for my students. But I didn't get it. Can you please help me? I didn't get it.
I suspect there are people here with a greater understanding of Hong Kong and China who may be in a better position to give you the secret recipe that will enable you to answer that question. For me, I mean, as I was trying to say, I mean, rule of law, all of these issues in relation to liberties, freedom of speech, freedom of association, at the end of the day, these are fundamental values on which a decent society should be based.
Your students are welcome to come to all of our events, and I'm sure they will.
My students would argue for enlightened dictator. I think so.
Thank you very much for the question. And once again, if you'd all join me in thanking Lord Peter Goldsmith for coming and giving us such a wonderful speech today.